the tahliyah process, and I define that tahliyah as that process in the backyard. First, before you grow your garden or you plant your vegetables, it's a wet pull all the weeds out, remove those blockages, remove those barriers of growth, and then now plant the seed and watch it grow. Same way, if we want to build towards Allah, fly towards Allah, gravitate and ascend towards Allah, we have to identify the weeds, identify the roadblocks, identify those anchors, and one by one, remove them. Otherwise, it becomes a very frustrating process. You dig the backyard, you grow, you water, you plant, you watch, nothing happens. Why? Well, because the elements weren't there for its growth. Same idea. I'm trying Asabhai, I'm trying Malana, I'm trying Sayyid. It doesn't work. Forget it. It's not for me. Well, the process was flawed, right? And so in the past two nights, we talked about two specific weeds inside of us that are stunting our growth towards Allah. One is this negative pessimism inside of us, that I can't do it. We begin to suspect Allah and think, maybe He doesn't want to see me succeed spiritually. And last time we talked about Ummul Fasad, the mother of all internal corruption, being the ego. We talked about the ego of the faithful, right? Not the ego of those who deny Allah. These are people who believe in Allah, who worship Allah, who act on Allah, and how Shaitan infiltrates into their acts and allows them not to actually believe that they are somebody. I am somebody because I've done a few mustahab acts in this world. Now, building from that, building on top of that, this Ummul Fasad, one thing that is born from the ego is the fact that we now become intolerant towards our own faults, okay? And very much aware of the faults of others. So we go through what's called the Aib Jui in Farsi. We begin to pick the faults of others and find the faults of others and look deeply and spend a lot of energy finding the faults of others. It is a massive problem inside of our families, inside of our communities. Now, let me, first of all, speak about the fact that, yes, in certain areas, in certain relationships, making others aware of the deficiencies and the faults that they have is actually beautiful. And I'll present to you a few hadiths. It's actually recommended. Right? So if the person in front of you is listing your faults or making you aware of your deficiencies, then you have to identify, number one, the niyat of the person in front of you. Now, sometimes that can't be done. Sometimes it's very obvious. And secondly, is that we can't group everybody under one roof. For example, we have to kind of give the benefit of the doubt to the people that we love, right? Our spouses, for example, our parents, for example, our siblings, our friends, those people who truly want to see me elevate, is we have to let ourselves know that if they have come to me and said, look, you should begin to work on this, my immediate reaction should not be defensive. Nor should I begin to question their niyat that all they want to do now is, destroy me. No, this is your wife, right? It's your husband. This is your parent. This is your mother or your father. This is your best friend. This is your brother or your sister. This is a guy you grew up with, for example. He wants to see you succeed. He wants to see you perfect yourself. Okay? And we can't perfect ourselves unless we identify those imperfections inside of us. It's a very simple and a very logical discussion. So there is one portion of this discussion on the person who's presenting the faults. There's also one person who's receiving that feedback. Okay, we as recipients of the feedback, we have to be a little bit more thick-skinned sometimes, and realize that this person in front of me is not my enemy. This person doesn't want to see me, destroyed. Their purpose is not to embarrass me, God forbid. Their purpose is, look, I see immense potential inside of you. You have all the tools to grow. These are a few things that are really stunting your growth. And me, as your spouse, as your wife, as your husband, as your mother, as your father, who's with you 24 hours a day, I can see things that others can't see. And you should not, at this moment, question my niyat. I'm not, we're on the same page. They say that, a husband and a wife are what? Are mirrors of each other. Well, the mirror does what? The mirror shows everything, right? Like this mirror on the wall business that we see in the fairy tales isn't there. It doesn't just, oh, you're the prettiest of them all. No, it's not like that. They'll actually show every scar, every pimple, every, the fact that you haven't had a haircut in 2 months. I really missed my haircut, right? All these things, yeah, it'll show you, because that's what a mirror does. Yes, it'll show you that, oh, you trimmed your beard so nicely today, like I did. You see that? And all lined up very nicely. It'll show you that. At the same time, it'll show you everything. That's how a spouse should be. Now, the hadith says, oh, Imam Ali is a beautiful hadith. Alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Muhammad. He says that the most beautiful person in your eyes, the most admired person in your eyes, is the one that presents your deficiencies to you as a gift. Look, we give, oh, it's such a beautiful Islamic discussion. We give these gifts to people, whatever gift you might give, right? We give the gift with the hope that they might, number one, be happy about it. Number two, they might use it. They might benefit from it. There's nothing better for me, at least, when I get a gift that's useful for me, right? That I can use right away. Oh my God, I was dying for that. You know, this is exactly what I needed, and I'm just so happy I'll start to use it, right? Imam Ali says that sometimes, depending on the person now, sometimes, you know, that person that presents your faults to you as a gift, that means that there is a certain way of presenting the faults. That person should be admired in your eyes. Another hadith says that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala falls in love with somebody, listen very carefully, please, I'll tell myself, so listen very carefully. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala falls in love with somebody, the immediate reaction and the effect of that love, that he makes them aware of their own faults. Why? Because that love is forcing him. That love is making it compulsory on him to make sure that the one that he loves is perfect in everything that they do. Everything that they do. So if my niyat is to perfect the person in front of me, then whatever comes from them has to be looked at as good and khair. Can't be said that, I want to share your faults with you. I want to do it so I can, I know that you can be a better person, but I'm just too scared. You're just not receptive to it, right? A lot of us, especially me, we're very thin-skinned sometimes. And a lot of it comes from where? The fact that we can't accept the faults of others, or accept the feedback from others, is because, we're individuals who are not aware of our own faults. It's a very direct connection, right? Western psychology, Islam as well says that as well, and again, I'll present to you some hadiths tonight that support this claim. The reason why we go around, not only are we not receptive to people giving us feedback, but we are able to now easily find the faults in others and not the fault in me, is because I'm oblivious to my faults. Partly because I don't want to face it. Maybe I think I don't have any. It goes back to my ego talk last night. Right? That mother of all corruption gives life to all of these various vices. One of them, of course, being I am Jewy and others, looking for faults in others, but not looking for the fault inside of you. Claiming you're perfect, right? Ignorance of your own faults equals to intolerance of the faults of others. Ignorance of your own faults, of my own faults, equals the intolerance of the faults of others. When we begin to understand that, yes, I have these deficiencies, when I see the same deficiencies in other people, I don't laugh, I don't celebrate their weaknesses, I actually empathize with those weaknesses. Right? And you can ask my siblings, growing up I was a very sensitive child. Some claim I still am, but I was a very sensitive child, very sensitive child. I was one of those annoying kids who, had to have, I had to blow out the candle at my cousin's birthday party. I still remember my siblings had their first Rosh Hashanah, okay? They had their first, celebration. Like, I wasn't even valid then, right? So they had just finished their first Rosh Hashanah, Ramadan in our house. We had a little bit of a celebration. Oh, my brother and my sister now began fasting Ramadan. I was not even valid. It's not even a wajib on me, but somehow there's pictures of me sitting there holding my pinky, crying in a corner. Why, when will it be that it is my Rosh Hashanah? To the point where my family, I just feel embarrassed telling you all this, to the point where my family would have to bring another gift for me, even though it has nothing to do with me, just because I was sensitive. Now, that was back then. Now, but because I'm fully aware now that how hypersensitive I was, and maybe somewhat I still am, when I look at a 12-year-old, 11-year-old, 10-year-old, who's also hypersensitive, I empathize, I sympathize. I now am fully aware of the fact that, you know, I was a very caring and loving kid, as they would say. That's a better way of saying it, right? But that's what happens when you become fully aware of the fact. Right? When you are ignorant towards, ghafil, heedless towards your own aib and your own faults, then of course the world is filled with faults, and that's all you see, is the faults of others. But the reality is that it's an inside-out process. Because remember, everything I'm saying right now, it's not easy, guys. I mean, building yourself, self-building, khudsazi, looking inward, it's very, very difficult. Western philosophy, Western psychology says one of the most difficult things any human can practice is introspection, is contemplation, is self-thought. We just don't do it because we're scared to do it. We're scared of what might come out of that process. And you know, because that happens, we just avoid the whole process altogether. It's so much easier, Asamhai, to talk about other people than to talk about me. It's so much easier and sometimes more enjoyable, God forbid, for me to sit there and pick at the faults of others than for me to pick up my own faults. That's not fun. So we don't do it. Another hadith by Imam Ali, the closest person to you is one who makes you aware of your faults. Right? The closest enemy of you, of yours, the closest enemy of yours is the one who presents to you as somebody who is perfect and flawless. Right? And what they do in the process is that they fool you to think that, yeah, I am perfect. And then thus the ego process kicks in. Let's be very careful. This is a situation, and this is a fault in us that's destroying families, destroying communities, destroying homes. Not only are we afraid to share the faults with our loved ones, we're also scared to hear those faults as well. And I get it. Sometimes it's the fact that, look, this is the person I love, right? The person that I've spent the rest of my life with, right? I don't want them to see me in that light. I don't like the fact that they're fully aware of my faults. So yeah, when I get upset, it's not upset at you, it's actually upset at myself. That why have I, not only do I have this fault, why was I able now to make the fault apparent to them? So this idea of fault finding is all based on niyyah. And your wife, your husband, your parent, your child, fair enough. But a random person in the community comes to you and says, look, brother, sister, you know, this, that, you know, your salat was this way, your hijab is this way, you know. For me, for example, people come to me and give me feedback, good and bad, about the lectures. You know, next time, you know, this was off, where'd you get this from? This wasn't good, that story didn't make sense, right? And you really have to sometimes adopt the saying of Imam Ali that don't look at who's saying it, look at what's being said. But if you are somebody who likes to give feedback to others about their faults and about their difficulties, and you know, you have, you know, husn azam, you have the best niyat, and the purest of niyats inside of me. I do it because I love you, I do it because I want to see you better, but, you know, my tone is rough. My delivery is off. You know, let's not just wrap up all with, you know, who cares about tone? Worry about what I'm saying. No, it's not like that. Tone sometimes is everything. Right? Up and down the Quran, Allah talks about lahja and lahja and tone and tone and tone. Right? Nabi Musa had that. وَقُولُ لَهُ قَوْلًا لَيِّنًا. I've often mentioned this very famous verse, that even God is telling Nabi Musa to go back to Fir'aun, tell him about Allah, but speak to him in a very soft tone. That maybe because of your soft tone, لَعَلَّهُمْ يَخْشَىٰ أَيَتَذَكُرُوا يَخْشَىٰ. Maybe because of that soft tone, maybe he might have khushu or dhikr of me inside of the heart. So yeah, it is how you say it, not always what you say. It's like the example that my father-in-law often gives, right? One says no smoking, one says don't you dare smoke, one has a cigarette and a light through it, and one says thank you very much for not smoking. Four of the exact same messages, different ways of saying it. Okay? But you know, there is a responsibility between the one who receives the feedback, the one who gives the feedback as well. Let's look at a few ahadiths I want to share with all of you, inshallah. So, sorry, salawat, please. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And again, I will tell you, there are some people that have the cruelest of niyas, and I'm sorry, that's a reality. They actually enjoy not only finding the fault, but what? Exposing the fault to others. And meanwhile, the Quran talks about, and Islam talks about what? The protection and of the dignity of the mu'min, right? Al-Afzal al-Ka'aba, the hadith says. The hurmat of the mu'min is higher than the Ka'aba. And we should do everything we can to what? To protect that dignity. If we believe in a communal religion, if I believe that his izzat or her izzat is ultimately my izzat and my respect, because we belong to the same deen, the same ummah, and same nation. Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He says, again, these are very profound ahadiths, and ones that, you know, I want all of, especially me, to ponder. He says, kafa bil mar'i ayban. It's enough of an ayb, it's enough of a fault, of a deficiency. It's enough for you, enough for me to say, this one fault is enough for me. I don't need 1,000 faults. This one fault is, what is that fault? He says, an yubsira min an-nasi man ya'ma anhu min nafsihi. That he tries and he picks and he looks for faults in others, those faults that actually he's blind to within himself. Meaning, you know, sometimes you find people that they talk about person A and person B, you know, she does this and he does that. And meanwhile, that person does that all day long. And you look at that person and say, are you serious right now? Do you know you're describing yourself right now? But the Quran says what? The hadith says what? Man ya'ama, they're blinded to their own faults. So same faults that exist inside of them, they're out there picking the faults of those others. That is enough of a deficiency, Imam Muhammad says. What more do you want? That's one hadith. The second hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wa salam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa anjil farajun. He says, "Man bahatha an ayyub al-nas, falyabda'u binafsihi." The person who busies himself looking into the faults of others. And there are some people who legitimately busy themselves all day long. They have nothing better to do than to snoop around, ask around, do some jasusi, do some spying. Right? We talked about suspicion, su'edan. We talked about Surah Hujurat. Surah Hujurat in verse number 11, I believe, talks about the fact that do not be individuals who suspect each other. Right? There are certain levels of suspicion that are outright sin. Because that suspicion leads to what? Leads to jasusi, that you just end up asking, not spying inside someone's house, but spying into their lives. Meaning that, you know, you ask, you find out, what happened over there? Oh, okay. And then you compare stories, and you come up with, and then you begin the backfiring process. Or I begin the backfiring process. All begins from the idea that we become obsessed with the lives of others. Why? What is the obsession with how other people live their life? How other people present themselves? Right? This person is, oh, look at her, look at him, he's everywhere, you know, just sit down. Just why? Just worry about yourself. Like I said, you know, sometimes when I go to see some married couples, sometimes they ask, you know, just come by and kind of help us out and, you know, maybe listen to us and give some advice. Sure. So I go and, you know, It's amazing how, and I think to an extent it's human nature, we become defensive, right? It's amazing how one spouse has all this advice for the other spouse, and that spouse has all the advice for this spouse. But when I asked him, you know, what are you going to do to fix this marriage? There's complete, there's crickets, there's silence. Either you think that I don't need to do anything, you know, I've done everything, what more can I, or you don't know where to start, or you've never been asked that question. Or if I ask people, and I tend to do that, I go, what will your husband tell me about you? Or what will your wife tell me about you? Well, you know, he might say this or she might say this. He says, the one who busies himself looking into the faults of others should what? Should start by looking into the faults of his own self. This is a communal movement. Like, it takes a village for us to fix ourselves. And you know, we have to stop looking outward and begin to fix the inside. And we need help in doing that. The prophet says that the worst person to consult with when you're trying to build yourself and rid yourself of any deficiencies is yourself. Profound statement. Why? Because, you know, either we are too hard on ourselves, where I am useless, I'm worthless, I'm held down, or we're way too lax on ourselves. That I'm Mr. Muttaqi, I'm everything, I'm better than 1,000 people, for sure there's Jannah for me waiting for me. And this is why, you know, sometimes you see in the discussion on Ma'ad and the Day of Judgment, sometimes you see, you know, this idea that one of the proofs that we have against it, for the Day of Judgment is that there is a mini Day of Judgment inside of us. You know, there's a judge, there's a jury, there's an executioner inside of us. Think about, you know, this nafsil lawama that we have, this regretful, remorseful soul that we have, right? We commit a sin against Allah, and we, before anyone else does, we feel immense regret, and we end up punishing ourselves. Why'd you do that? Why are you so weak? Why can't you be better? Right? The judge has already laid down the sentence, the jury has already found you guilty, and you are also the defendant. So you're all in one. That's a little bit of a, you know, a qiyamat as-sughra inside of you, a little small Day of Judgment. The problem with that is that it is not based on justice. It's based on what we believe to be our version of justice for our own self. So either it's the fact that we make a mistake and we beat ourselves up over it, that I'm zero, I'm worthless, I can't even praise Allah, what's the point? Or to the point where I justify that mistake, saying, oh, come on, everyone does it, not a big deal. People do 1,000 things worse than I do. That's one thing I've done a long time. Either one is wrong, right? So we need that actual Day of Judgment to truly, based on God's adalah, to truly go ahead and administer whatever justice that needs to be administered. My point is that we need outside factors to help us grow on the inside. Don't push people, I'm not talking to myself here, as I always say, I'm the first one. Don't push those people away from you that really, truly, truly are looking to help you. If you can, look beyond their tone. Maybe they don't have the lovey-dovey words that you're looking for, you know, wrap it in a nice bow, this and that. You ever see, you know, sometimes the wrapping is worth more than the actual gift is inside? Right? So sometimes people like me are just stuck on the wrapping. Tear open the wrapping. What's inside the box is more important. I'm like, no, where's my bow? Where's the way you wrapped it? It's okay. This person, inside is the actual maqlab and the content. That's where we have to truly focus on. And thank that person. Imam says that they're presenting a gift to you by telling you your faults. How many of us can bardash that? One person beside me in Jamaat says, you know, I don't know if your sajda was, who are you telling me about sajda? I've been doing sajda for many, many years. My sajda, Baba, I'm just telling you as a brother of yours that maybe you could try to flatten your palm during sujood. I know my sajda. Don't go on, Hoya. Don't worry about it. Said, ooh. Right? So we're not ready, quite ready to accept that, but it's a communal movement towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One more hadith, this is very, very important. You know, and it goes back to, you know, remember I talked about that 2 nights ago, that the hadith says that the individual who is ahli rayb, who's constantly in doubt, constantly suspicious, always negative, if you spend your time around people like that, fahuwa murib, the hadith says, you become like that. You become like that. You just become suspicious and suspicious and negative. Always, everyone is zidus salat. Everyone is under question. This hadith also says the exact same thing, but in a different way. Again, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, we are blessed with his words on the day of Ishad. May Allah allow us to apply these words in our life. He says, "Iyakum wa ma'ashira." I warn you. I warn you about keeping relations with who? Mutadabbi'u uyubin nas, about people who constantly look for the faults in others. Why, he says, فَإِنَّهُ لَمْ يَسْلَمْ مُصَاحِبَهُمْ مِنْهُمْ, because you yourself will not be spared by them, Allah. You won't be spared by them. In another related tradition, he says, the one who talks to you about others will talk about you to others, Imam. Same idea. the one who constantly finds faults in others and shares that with you, the tus-tus-tus-tus-tus inside your ear during the majlis now, versus in your ear, trying to move up in your ear, in your, oh, look what she's wearing, look what he's wearing, oh, look who showed up, blah, 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 oh my God, I can't believe, did you hear about his house and his kids and that divorce, and then, you think for a second that they're not going to turn around and talk about you, no, absolutely, he warns us for that. Let's be very careful. Let's not surround ourselves. It goes back to what I always, always talk about is avoiding a toxic circle of influence. My youth out there, my young guys out there, pick and choose your boys properly. Pick and choose your sisters properly. Surround yourself with the right people. I don't care if it's 5 people, 10 people, 1 person. Do not be those individuals who surround themselves with people that when you're with them, the shaitan comes out inside of you. A perfectly good mu'min, a sister in front of you, now has become somebody that you know every fault of theirs. A perfectly good brother that you thought was a good mu'min brother, a great guy, he's such a good-hearted guy. I said, hey, you sat with a couple of guys and now you know everything about his life. And now no longer is he this pious, soft-hearted individual. Let's be careful. Let's understand that those individuals who do bring our faults to us, and have the right niyat. And it, like I said, loved ones around us, accept that as their way of helping us, perfecting us. They see things in such that maybe we are blind to see for ourselves. May Allah protect us and may Allah guide us on this path to first of all examine the faults inside of me and then work to inshallah build that and correct it. Let's move together towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let's cleanse our hearts. Let's ask Him sincerely to forgive our sins and watch as you fly towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you very much. May Allah bless each and every one of your families. Please stay safe and stay healthy. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahu Akbar, la ilaha illallah.
There. Welcome to the lighter side of the news. It's great to have you with us. Artificial intelligence is fast growing and already touching many aspects of our daily lives. And now, a humanoid robot becomes the world's first machine artist to ever auction its own digital artwork. What is this world coming to? The robot called Sophia sold the artwork, which was in the form of a non-fungible token, for nearly $700,000. Sophia, who was unveiled in 2016 by a Hong Kong-based company, produced her art in collaboration with Italian digital artist Andrea Bonassetto. The artwork is a 12-second MP4 file showing the evolution of Bonassetto's portrait into Sophia's digital painting.
So, thank you very much for joining with me and supporting me today. The virtual, the real, the imaginal, and the literal. This kind of spirit of creativity and technology working together gives me hope that we can solve anything.
And we've been exploring Sophia's creativity on the side, but we really have been developing her as a platform and as a character more than as a work of fine art.
Since her activation, Sophia has achieved widespread appeal due to her unsettling human-like appearance, compounded with the complex ability to express emotions. She has appeared on talk shows and spoken at conferences about issues ranging from artificial intelligence to the role of robots. Hanson Company says Sophia now has simulations of every major muscle in the human face and can generate multiple expressions such as joy, grief, curiosity, and frustration.
Nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to enjoy the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Meguro River to see stunning cherry trees in full blossom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the coronavirus pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital were also cancelled. A new study has revealed that octopuses probably dream while sleeping just as humans do. Scientists in Brazil believe that the eight-legged animals experience two sleeping phases, active and quiet. During the active stage, the octopus's skin color changes. They also move their eyes and twitch their bodies. According to the study, they might have short dreams in this period. To do their research, scientists observed four octopuses while they were sleeping in the lab. Mammals, birds, and some reptiles also experience a two-phase sleep cycle. Many people have experienced the healing power of music. Now, a violinist in Brazil has taken advantage of the popular idea to spread joy and calm in COVID-hit hospitals. Cristiano has volunteered to play the violin for patients and health workers in Rio de Janeiro. According to the violinist, music should be played in all hospitals as it renews hope and eases stress. He says people are more isolated during the coronavirus pandemic, so they need music more than ever to stay motivated. Experts believe music therapy can also reduce heart rate and blood pressure.
A successful treasure hunt in China, archaeologists have made valuable finds in the country's southwestern Sichuan province. Researchers excavating the Sanxi Zhu ruins have made new discoveries that help shed light on the eventful Chinese history. Some of the artifacts unearthed date back to over 3,000 years ago. Some of the most interesting objects include a 70-centimeter-long bronze ware and a Savonia gold mask. More precious remains could be found there, as only 2% of the site has been excavated so far. In the latest round, over 500 artifacts were found. An Egyptian engineer has designed a robot to help frontline doctors do their life-saving work with more safety.
This robot is especially designed to help the medical staff during COVID-19 times. It is a medical robot capable of multitasks. It can deal with patients in their beds and help with chest scans, fever screening, and face mask detection.
Mahmoud's prototype robot is remote controlled. It can carry out PCR swab tests without causing pain. The robot is being tested in a private hospital for now, where it receives training to improve its artificial intelligence. Doctors say the ingenious invention has proven very useful so far, as it minimizes exposure to the virus. This Californian surfer is not famous for his surfing skills, but for his very special company on a surfboard, Pismo the Goat. The 80-year-old goat seems to be enjoying the waves a lot, even the very large ones. Dana McGregor, also known as the Goat Surfer, says he uses the experience for teaching children how to surf. He says riding with a goat on a surfboard has calming effects and will make children less scared of the sea and the waves. His students also describe the experience as fun and pleasant. McGregor started his goat surfing journey 10 years ago. What is the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear about a volcanic eruption in your vicinity? Of course, fear, chaos, or probably a plan to flee. But that is not the case with Icelanders. Thousands of curious onlookers flocked to an erupting volcano to marvel at the hypnotic display of glowing red lava. Iceland's Mount Fagradalsfjall began erupting late Friday after almost 900 years. Its lava bubbles and spurts from a small cone in a valley were seen piling up in a basin. It was a joyous moment for Icelanders, who are usually exhausted with chilly weather. Access to the site was blocked initially, but authorities then lifted the roadblocks under strict guidelines. The bravest of the onlookers found grilling hot dogs and marshmallows over the smoldering ashes. A Ukrainian fisherman saves the day with his biggest catch by fishing out an 11-year-old boy from an icy river. The boy said he didn't know how to swim and had drifted some 20 meters away from the shore on an ice floe while playing with his schoolmates. The fisherman threw his spinning rod to the boy and then reeled him in. Fortunately, the incident was noticed by two other men who were fishing nearby and came to help pull the boy from the water. The dramatic moment and the daring rescue from the Desenka River in Kyiv on Sunday was filmed by a fisherman and went viral on social media. And Japanese usually flock to natural reservoirs and parks during the cherry blossom season, which starts with the arrival of spring. But this year is a bit different, as coronavirus restrictions deter many to attend such festive gatherings. Flower viewing parties have been banned as the country is slowly reemerging from a strict 10-week lockdown. Still, people are defying restrictions not to miss the floral spectacular, but of course with masks and at designated areas. Hanami, or cherry blossom viewing, is an old Japanese tradition. In normal years, the appearance of the delicate pink flowers is the cue for families and friends to spread out picnic blankets on the cherry trees. Each year, it also draws many tourists from all over the world. A Colombian pianist has proved that animals enjoy music just like humans do. Mario Fernando Prado has created a relaxing atmosphere in a zoo in northern Colombia. He plays some of the world's most famous classical songs for animals. He believes that music brings peace and calm to any animal, from lions to flamingos. Zoo officials say the initiative is a wonderful experience for both animals and visitors. Of course, that's not the first time Prado does so. He has played the piano for animals in different places in the past. Now, the coronavirus may have shut down many social activities in India, but it can never stop the festive spirit of spring. This year, like previous ones, Indians are making preparations for the upcoming Holi festival, which starts on March 28th this year. This spectacular ritual runs for 2 days and is the second biggest festival on the Hindu calendar. When Holi arrives, people play with colors and try delicious local food. The celebration signifies the triumph of good over evil and is marked as a day of spreading happiness and love. Holi is also known as the festival of love and colors. Taking care of one's dental health is an absolute must, no matter humans or animals. A 14-year-old Siberian tiger has undergone a dental operation in a French zoo. The dentist took good care of the animal and even administered eye drops so that his eyes would not go dry during the procedure. Baikal broke his fangs 7 years ago while playing around, prompting the zoo owners to have her tooth revitalized and filled. The operation was successful, and the playful cat is now enjoying a brand new fang. That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. Jahlil Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamun alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Salaamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. How are you?
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
Brother Miqdad, one of our listeners has a question. She asked that, how do I teach my eldest son, who is 9, to take care of his younger sister, who is 4? I feel that he's always doing his own things and not watching out others. So what do you suggest this mother to do? So she feels that her child is growing up and now eldest son needs to take care of the other things as well.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So it's an interesting question. Let me mention a couple of points. First and foremost, it's important to realize that taking care of others and watching out for others is something that is actually a burden for the human being, mm-hmm. right? It's not an easy thing, and it's not something that comes very naturally in most of us,
yeah.
right? It actually requires us to think about it and to realize the importance of it. Mm-hmm. And it's often a burden.
Yeah.
It's often heavy, right? Mm-hmm. And for children who are busy playing, who are busy having fun, mm-hmm. to take care of others and to watch out for others is actually a hindrance to their fun and play.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually heavy for them,
mm-hmm.
because it adds a responsibility for them, right? Mm-hmm. And as naturally, we don't like taking up responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to realize that our level of expectation for a 9-year-old should be realistic.
Mm-hmm.
That 9-year-olds are not going to take care of their sister or brother. And to expect them to do so is beyond realistic, and it can actually have a negative consequence on them as well,
mm-hmm.
because it can lead to hatred, it can lead mm-hmm. to frustration.
Yeah.
It's not the right thing to do to impose on them
mm-hmm.
the watching out and caring for their
mm-hmm.
siblings, basically, mm-hmm. right? Parents should do their own responsibility and play the role of parents and ensure that nothing dangerous happens. Now, having said that, obviously, you slowly want to create this mm-hmm. feeling in a child
yeah.
From the age of 9 onwards, and you want them to be of that kind of personality that mm-hmm. they are caring towards others, watching out for others, ready to take up this responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But the way to do this is not by imposing upon them, mm-hmm. because it'll just create hatred towards
yeah.
it. It'll just create a negative feeling towards it. You want to slowly grow them into this understanding that it is actually an important responsibility,
mm-hmm.
a noble responsibility
yeah.
to have. That unfortunately not many of us have, but those who have, you can tell that these people are noble people.
Mm-hmm.
They are ready to sacrifice their own fun and time, etc., to look out for others,
yeah,
to
yeah.
Watch out for others and to help others
mm-hmm.
In different spheres.
So, like, keeping the age of the brother and the sister in mind, so I don't think it's really a thing to worry about. Like, you know, brother not watching out his sister. So I don't think it's really a thing to worry about. So rather, do you suggest that right now is the time that mother watches out after her children?
Yes, so I definitely don't think it's something to worry about. I wouldn't say that a child has an issue or a particular deficiency because he's not taking care or watching out for his sister. And from now on, slowly we do want to talk about how to slowly ingrain this
mm-hmm.
responsibility
yeah.
in a child, inshallah.
Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, and dear audience, stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Please, stop! IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Islamic upbringing from IRIB English Radio. And keeping the question in mind, we're discussing that is it really a thing to worry about that the brother is not watching out after her sister? So Brother Mubarak, please continue.
So one of the things that happens is that when a child has a lot of respect for their mom or their dad, when they see their mom and dad watching out for their young children and taking care of them, they naturally feel of doing the same, right? It's a very natural thing. I don't know if you've seen this. Children from the very young age, from the age of 3, 4, they play this game called mommy and daddy, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of them becomes a mom and mom becomes a dad, or one of them becomes a mom and one becomes a child. Yeah. And they practice taking care of one another, right? Yeah. So you see in this game, one child pretends to cry because she's the baby or he's the baby, and the other child comes and consoles them and takes care of them. So this naturally happens, and you'll find that this, as children grow, in 10, 7, 8, 9, if they've seen their parents do this, then they will naturally, very slowly, build this idea and this image in their mind that this is how I ought to be as well. That if I'm going to be responsible, then I'm going to be like this. So they need to watch their parents, and so parents need to show them how it's done practically without saying it. Right. The best places to do so is when you go on camping trips or traveling together, right? Or you're out of the normal routine. And this is where parents need to tell the children, for example, we need to walk this way, don't do this, this could be dangerous. You can play over here, but it's the first time we've come over here, so let's explore how it is. They're actually showing the child, asking the child, for example, are you okay? How are you feeling about this? When they do this with both the children, the eldest one will realize, oh, this is how it's done, basically. This is what I can see my parents do this. And then slowly, slowly, when the parents actually takes a step back and removes themselves from the picture very gently, the eldest son will naturally take up this position because they've seen it. It's something that they've actually witnessed and experienced. So I've seen this in families where the younger child is actually quite, others would say, mature. Right, but rather than being mature, it's just copying what the dad or the mom does, basically, in asking the younger siblings, are you okay, can I help you, watching out for them. They've got a sense of caringness and a sense of watching out for others, built on the fact that they've seen their parents do so.
So basically, children learn these characteristics from their parents.
That's correct.
So thanks so much, Brother Mikdad. To your audience, it's time for a short break. We'll be right back after a short break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. And we were discussing with Brother Mikdad that the children learn certain characteristics from their parents, like watching out for their younger siblings. They learn it from their parents. So, Brother Mugdal, please continue.
Another way to actually slowly ingrain this attitude is to make the child feel responsible, mm-hmm. right? Either by giving him a title of being a leader, for example, when you go on an activity or on a camping trip,
yeah.
he's the leader of the group, for example, or by giving him a responsibility, an official term that you're responsible
yeah.
for this,
yeah.
Making it as an important role
mm-hmm.
That goes back to self-importance and self-respect, mm-hmm. that you are able to do so, therefore you have become responsible for this particular act, whether it's,
yeah.
for example, making sure that your sister has eaten her lunch, for example,
mm-hmm.
etc. This actually makes the child feel very important.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, the child is going to put all their effort towards this responsibility and ensure that this happens. Now, this is very, very good and perhaps one of the really good ways to create this
mm-hmm.
feeling. However, we have to be very careful to ensure that the responsibility we're giving to a child is something that the child can and is
uh-huh.
able to do
yeah,
and able to
yeah.
carry out.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we give more than is expected, and then the failure will actually make it worse
yeah.
for the child.
Yeah.
So on one side, you've given them the responsibility that they are able to do so, and it doesn't feel too heavy, and the
mm-hmm.
child is capable of fulfilling this task. And at the same time, you've also taught the child how to do so.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important as well. Sometimes you make a child the leader of the group, okay, and you
mm-hmm.
tell them, okay, it's your responsibility to lead this group up to a particular place, but you haven't taught them how to do so.
Yeah.
You haven't taught them how to use a map. You haven't taught them all the different signs that are available out there, the signal posts, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And this leads to a failure because they don't have the tools in their
mm-hmm.
in their hands.
Yeah.
So whilst you give them a responsibility that they are able to act upon, you also teach them the different tools. And you make it very clear that what are the duties and responsibility that this leader has to do.
Yeah, so over here, that mother knows it very well what their children can do or what they cannot do. So the mother should have this in mind and, you know, give them the task according to that.
Definitely. They say when you sign a contract, you make
uh-huh.
it very clear what it entails,
yeah.
right? What are the different responsibility that the child should do because
uh-huh.
now he's a leader or because he's in charge
yeah.
of this particular act. So if we do this, then what happens is that the child slowly fulfills this
mm-hmm.
responsibility in the best of ways. And obviously parents encourage, parents give them that confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this sense of success, this sense of achievement actually creates this feeling in the child that they are able to bear this responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
After this, naturally, without the need to actually then make it official thing that you're responsible for this particular short time period that we're in the
mm-hmm.
camp, for example, we're a 2-day trip, then naturally it will come naturally for the child, basically,
yeah.
to be able to look out for others, watch out for others, take care, help out.
Yeah.
This is really, it will come naturally, basically,
yeah.
because they've got this sense of self-importance and they realize that they're in a position where they can help
mm-hmm.
others. And helping others is something that we actually enjoy. There's a sense of achievement in that.
So thank you so much, Brother Mugdal. And I'm really sorry, dear audience, the time's up. So inshallah, we'll continue this in the next show. So in this program, we're discussing how an elder brother can watch out for her younger sister. So we said different ways that children basically learn these type of characteristics from their mothers. So thank you so much, dear audience, for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. And visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until the next program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so very much for joining me on today's episode of The Lantern here on IRIB English Radio. As always, it's an honor and a privilege to have the opportunity to be with you guys today. And I hope that whatever we discuss on today's episode of The Lantern first and foremost benefits me and reminds me to be a better person. And can provide you guys with some interesting, useful facts that you might have not known or had forgotten for a while. Anyway, one of the most important, prominent, and vital teachings, Islam and the Holy Book of Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, instructs us and advises us about is gratitude. Let's listen to a short story about this point, and we will be right back.
The title of today's story is The Clever Monkey. Once upon a time, there was a clever monkey who lived on a beautiful island in an apple tree. One day, a crocodile swam to the island. "I'm hungry," he said. So the monkey threw a red apple to the crocodile. The crocodile munched and munched. The next day, the crocodile came back. "Please, may I have two apples?" he asked. He ate one and gave one to his wife. The crocodile went to see the monkey every day to listen to his tales and eat his apples. He wanted to be clever, just like the monkey. The crocodile's wife had an idea. "Why don't you eat his heart? Then you'll be clever just like him." The next day, he said to the monkey, "Come to my house. We'll have lunch together to thank you for the apples." But when he arrived, the crocodile snapped and said, "Monkey, I want to eat your heart so I can be as clever as you." The clever monkey thought quickly and said, "But I haven't got my heart here. It's on the island in the apple tree." They all went back to the island. "Wait here, and I will get my heart," said the monkey. The monkey quickly climbed the tree and sat at the top. "Oh, crocodile, you are greedy. Of course you can't have my heart. And now you can't have my apples too." And the clever monkey laughed and laughed.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Gratitude is literally the defining point between faith and disbelief. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Quran that if you thank me, I will increase for you. And if you are ungrateful, and the word used for that in the Quran or in the